Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, May 1st, 2018. A South Sudanese doctor says President Kiir needs medical attention.
When you are a government official, like when you are a president of the country, you become a public figure. Your health status, people need to know about it. That is not against medical ethics.
And South Sudan's presidential spokesman insists Mr. Kiir is not sick.
The president is healthy. We know we are working for him. And without any flattering, the president comes to the office from as early as 8 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes if he is late, he has come late, it will be 9 o'clock, 9:15.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese-Canadian trained doctor said he saved lives of many patients at Juba Teaching Hospital during the December 2013 crisis in Juba. Dr. Mawen Accord claims he was also part of the presidential medical unit responsible for offering medical services to President Salva Kiir. Accord claims President Kiir needs medical attention. He says he had told authorities in Juba about Mr. Kiir's health issues.
There were about 300 patients that came to Juba Teaching Hospital with gunshot wounds. And because of what I have implemented, only 44 died and the rest were safe.
There's a lot on the social media. There are people who are saying that you have gone beyond your medical ethics to talk about the state of health of the President of the Republic. In the interview you did with the Jonkuri, you said President Kiir's health status are not good. They say that is against medical ethics. Why did you go to that extent?
My explanation is, you know what, when we talk about medical ethics, I respect the privacy. There is what we call Medical Health Protection Act, which is not existent in South Sudan. It is in Canada here, where your information are protected. But when you are a government official, like when you are the president of the country, you become a public figure. Your health status, people need to know about it. That is not against medical ethics. It's just a simple thing that I can say. The president is not in the sound mind, is not in the sound body to lead the country.
What are his health issues?
Well, you know, I'll not go in details. But let me cite one example. When the president went to see the body of Andro Makur, people were actually not looking at the casket. They were looking at the president as being the sick person.
People in Juba would be wondering as to why you're not opening up to give us details, because you say it is a public figure.
He's a public figure, and what I know, the president has some liver issues.
And for how long has that been going on?
It's been going on for quite some time, and I'm afraid if it is not addressed, it will be fatal.
Why are you bringing this information at this time? Is it because you just left South Sudan and you're now happy you can say anything you want to?
No, not at all. You know, I've been outspoken even when I was in the country.
Have you been talking about these issues inside the country? I mean, I would imagine if you say such things in Juba, they will come for you within a minute.
Yes, I have been talking about them in Juba, but people don't want to hear them.
Who are these people who don't want to hear them? I mean, you're talking in general terms. Let's go to specifics here.
The national security.
I was also reading some comments on the social media that you are just used by the rebels to tarnish the image of the country. They are saying
No. Whatever
you are saying is not true. You belong to Paul Malong, and that's why you are speaking.
I'm not associated with any rebel group. I'm just speaking as a normal citizen and a concerned physician in the country.
Other colleagues who are in the medical field, they have come up openly saying that you have crossed the red line. There is a client-doctor privacy confidentiality that you are not supposed to talk about it, whatsoever the case.
And this is what I was talking about. You know, in South Sudan, there is no any regulation that actually protects the patient's privacy. In Canada, we have what is called HIPAA, Health Information Protection Act. It is not in South Sudan, so I'm not crossing the line.
I also did some research and discovered that you were transferred from Juba Hospital to go to Awil Hospital, and you refused to go there. Why did you refuse to go to Awil?
Because, you know, what the Minister of Health, Dr. Riak Guy Kok, is doing is actually a political medicine. It's not a real medicine. And political medicine.
What is political medicine? This is the first time I'm hearing this term. What is political medicine?
Because he even lies to the president. You know, I'll recall one example. When Dr. John Garang Diagnostic Center was opened, Dr. Riak Guy stood in front of the president, and I was there myself, me and him and the president. And there is a big fridge. He said, this one has the DNA machine. There was nothing inside there. That's what I call political medicine.
And so you refused to go to Awil because of that situation you're calling political medicine?
Yes.
But what has that got to do with saving lives in Awil? Because you're supposed to go there and save lives of people who don't have access to doctors.
I was saving more lives in Juba. You know, I'm from Awil, but I practice in Juba, and I have been saving a lot of lives. And in Juba, there are a little bit more facilities that I can do what I can do as a doctor trained in Canada. For example, in Awil, you don't have a CT machine. You don't have any theater. You don't have nothing. So what am I going to do there? Only to watch people die?
That's Dr. Mawena Kod, a South Sudanese Canadian doctor who worked in South Sudan. He was speaking with me from Canada yesterday. South Sudan's presidential spokesman, Ateng Wek Ateng, disputes claims by the doctor that President Kiir is sick and unfit to run the country. Ateng says Kiir's health condition is good, adding the president is busy with his official functions. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Juba.
Ateng says he was surprised to hear Dr. Mawien Akot's remarks about the president's health status late last week. He says Akot has never examined Kiir and questioned how the doctor could have access to the president's records.
It is not about anything that the president does in his health that is subject to discussion. Dr. Mawien is assumption, you know, was on assumption, was talking on assumption. Because the president is a human being. Can you tell me if there is any other president in the whole world that, you know, has a medical record being discussed by anybody? Apart from that, he never had a chance. He never had a chance to examine the president. So where did he get the records?
Ateng says President Kiir works about 10 hours every day. Kiir's spokesman says he wonders if a sick person could manage such a hectic routine.
The president is healthy. We know we are working for him. And without any plateauing, president comes to the office from as early as 8 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes if he has come late, it will be 9 o'clock, 9:15. And will be in the office beyond the normal hours that the head of the state is expected to work.
The presidential spokesman says Dr. Akot has lost credibility and should be investigated by the South Sudan Medical Council.
Mawien has gone out of completely medical practice, and the medical council need to check this guy, whether his qualifications are still intact or he has developed mental unfairness, which is a concern for the ordinary citizen who would be treated by Dr. Mawien.
Ateng says Dr. Akot has never been a member of the presidential medical unit in Juba. He says since 2005, there are only two doctors who have checked President Kiir's health status. Dr. Andrew Akonakech is the head of the presidential medical unit and Kiir's personal doctor. He issued a statement Monday stressing that President Kiir is busy with his work schedule. Ateng admits that Dr. Akot has in the past been consulted to refer South Sudanese for treatment outside the country. But Ateng says none were government or military officials.
And I have been seeing those papers, you know, flying, bearing the signature of him. Okay, even those who are not sick, of course, I can confirm that. Mawien is the one doing it. Even those who have never been military people, he has been giving them the medical transfer. So I have never asked him to give me medical transfer because if I need money, I don't need the medical transfer to get money.
Atani accuses Dr. Accord of seeking attention from the President Kiir's opponents. Atani claims Dr. Accord is loyal to former SPLA Chief of General Staff Paul Malonga Wan, who now leads the opposition South Sudan United Front. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Still in Juba, an employee of the Seventh-day Adventist Development and Relief Agency, also known as ADRA, was gunned down last Tuesday by armed men in Terekeka State's Tali County. Ayendeng Bior has details from Washington.
ADRA has identified the deceased aid worker as Agoyo Robert, who was working for South Sudan's Health Pooled Fund project, a program that expands health services to people across the country. Last Tuesday, unknown gunmen fired at a vehicle in which Robert and others were traveling in to Terekeka. Two people died, including Robert. John Mwanza, ADRA's country director, says the incident was not an ambush, and he does not believe his colleague was targeted for his work.
From the look of things, it looks like it was not something that was planned, because they just ran into this situation. I have gone to Terekeka before, and I think for some time the road has been safe, but we don't know what led to this particular incident.
Mwanza says details are still unclear, and survivors of the incident are still in the hospital.
Even from those who were injured, who were in the hospital, they say that they do not know how many there were. And of course, also, it was at night, so they could not really see who was firing the gunshot.
ADRA released a statement yesterday condemning the attack, which happened 1 week ago.
We were trying to also get more information. Even us here in Juba to get information from our staff, it took time to really to, not really from the staff, but also even from those patients who were in hospital. It looks like many of them were not in a position to answer us, so that we're able to get information from staff in trying to get more details so that we can see how we can share with our international office.
At least 100 aid workers have been killed in South Sudan, according to UN OCHA. Ayendeng Bior, VOA News, Washington.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up on our health segment, we take a look at a killer disease. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what advice would you give to a newly married couple?
I would advise them to respect each other's view, to listen to one another, and to be committed to each other.
If they want just to be as a good wife and husband at their homes, they should not listen to advice from other people, because other people can intervene into their relationship. We best see that they are proceeding ahead in a good way.
First, they have to be too honest themselves. Secondly, they have to be faithful. Thirdly, they have to be transparent.
Sometimes the husband may have another idea which is contrary to the wife. So that means they have to sit down, see like the differences, and then try to bridge it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are talking about efforts to combat the spread of malaria. After 16 years of steady decline, malaria cases are on the rise again globally, and experts warn that unless efforts to tackle the disease are stepped up, the gains could be lost. Henry Ridgewell reports from a malaria summit in London where delegates called for a boost in funding for global anti-malaria programs.
For many years, World Malaria Day has been a cause for celebration, but not this year. World Health Organization data show that starting in 2016, progress has been at a standstill and hopes of ending the global epidemic by 2030 are slipping away. Director of WHO's Global Malaria Program, Pedro Alonso, says some of the gains made in reducing the number of cases and deaths in countries across all regions of the world are being reversed.
As a consequence, we now have about 216 million cases of malaria every year, in excess of 440,000 deaths every year. History has taught us very clearly that when we stop making progress, it's not that we just stand still, but we go backwards, and then malaria comes back, and comes back with a vengeance.
About 90% of all malaria cases and deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa. Children under the age of 5, pregnant women, and patients with HIV/AIDS are most at risk. Alonso says global political commitment must be renewed and donors in affected countries must increase the financial resources needed to successfully tackle malaria.
And we need new and improved tools to prevent, diagnose and treat malaria. Our sense is that with the resources available today and with the tools we have today, we have seen the limit of what can be achieved.
The issue of malaria's resurgence came up on the sidelines of a Commonwealth summit in London this month, where Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, who has invested billions of dollars in fighting malaria, pledged yet another $1 billion to the effort. WHO estimates $5.5 billion are needed each year to wage a successful global fight against malaria. However, only about half that amount has been pledged. Vector control is the main way to prevent and reduce the spread of malaria. Alonso says better insecticides, better insecticide-treated mosquito nets, as well as better drugs are essential in combating the disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Israel has cancelled plans to send African migrants from Sudan and Eritrea to Uganda. Carol Van Dam speaks with Ismail Kushkush about the situation of African migrants in Israel.
There was a lot of confusion. I did meet with a number of Sudanese and some Eritrean migrants and plan to meet more. Most of them, you know, have been here. Many have been here for over 10 years. You know, most came after 2005 from Egypt. And their status has just been unclear. The government does not want to recognize them as refugees, though most of them had escaped conflict either in Sudan. Most are either from Darfur, from the Numa Mountains. Many were also from South Sudan. And then many also from Eritrea is escaping indefinite military conscription in the country.
So if they are escaping violence at home, why aren't they given refugee status by the Israeli government?
Well, that's the question, and that's what you know progressive advocates in the country here, and there are a number of organizations have been saying that you can't send these people back. They've escaped either torture or escaped conflicts in the countries. You know, this is a hot political issue in Israel. The political right in the country sees them and describes them as infiltrator, using a term that was once described for Palestinian militants attacking Israel in the 50s. And there's also a degree of, anti-black racism. There have, at times officials or even religious figures have described African refugees here as either monkeys or as a cancer in society. And there have been protests, calling for, Sudanese to go back home to Sudan.
We'll get into that a little bit about the politics of it. Where does the parliament stand? And are they mostly with Netanyahu? Or I know you have this coalition government there in Israel, and, he has to try to appeal to these different blocs and then come forth with some kind of majority opinion on all matters. And this one just seems like a particularly sticky one. Where does it stand right now with Parliament?
It depends on, you know, what political party, and it shifts. I mean, again, this is just a big debate and a lot of back and forth. Government announces one thing, then it changes its mind. Pressure from one side or the other. You know, I don't think there's one solid stance from the government. Definitely the government within is divided on this topic.
Where does it go from here? Has there been any indication from the government what it plans to do now? Uganda was willing to accept some 500 of them.
What is clear, that what we know, is that it is going to reopen detention centers that were established for these refugees, the most infamous one being Holot in the southern part of the country. Now, as far as resettlement agreements, we know that Uganda and Rwanda allegedly have accepted plans to accept African refugees from Israel, but officially these governments have denied it, and it seems again the rhetoric from that side is, you know, changes and shifts. There have been a number of investigative reports saying that indeed Africans from Israel have been deported to Rwanda and Uganda, but at the governmental level, there's been a lot of denial of that. This is also, you know, a legal issue here, not just a political issue. The High Court here in Israel says that the government cannot deport these asylum seekers if there is no clear agreement with these supposedly hosting countries.
Talk a little bit about the detention centers themselves. What kind of conditions are there at these detention centers?
These are open detention centers in the desert. They've hosted groups of Africans they're like big prisons, basically. You know, they're not a place a welcoming place.
That's reporter Ismail Kushkush speaking from Jerusalem with my colleague Carol Van Damme. In France, thousands of young migrants are camping along a canal in Paris, waiting for a chance to cross into Great Britain or to apply for asylum in France. The camp has sprung up quickly over the past few months, in part because the French government has shut down or relocated other migrant camps and facilities. Journalist Catherine Field visited the camp and met with migrants there. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson today about the situation.
The canal side in Paris, which is in the northeast of Paris, at the moment it's home to about 3,000 migrants. And the reason that the numbers have grown so much in the last couple of months is because essentially the Calais route to the United Kingdom has closed down. So they've all moved back to the northeast of Paris. And along that canal area and along the area which is all the underpasses of the main Paris ring road, they've been able to set up camps there. The majority of them are young men from Sudan, Eritrea, Libya, and Ethiopia. And they essentially are just there waiting for whatever chance they can get to the United Kingdom or even to put in an application for asylum here in France. The problem with France is that once you put in your application for asylum, you still don't get any government help. It can take up to 18 months for that process to chug through. And it's not until you have been accepted as an asylum seeker, as a refugee in France, that the government actually gives you help.
The photo that you showed me, the camp looks relatively orderly and tidy. Is that the reality, or is this an issue where it's going to become overcrowded and become a health and security issue?
It already is a health and security issue in many parts. You've got NGOs such as Médecins Sans Frontières, Médecins du Monde coming through twice a week and giving free health care. The Paris Town Hall is also once a week sending in a team to do health checks. They're checking in particular for tuberculosis and also for psychological problems. Let's not forget, a lot of these young men have come from war zones, areas where there have been human rights abuses. They've come by boat across the Mediterranean, made their way up to Paris on foot, by road, by jumping on and off trains. So some of them have psychological problems. So yes, the health issue is really of paramount importance. But these are also areas of Paris that are really overcrowded already. You've got houses, you've got apartment blocks without a lot of working class poor people living there. So these are areas already overcrowded, having problems with sanitation, having problems with getting litter collected off the street, having problems getting their own everyday garbage collected from rubbish bins. So these are areas where you have just all of these problems of sanitation and overcrowding coming together.
What is the city government and the national government, what are they doing?
What they have already done is they have set up about 750 places for migrants to go outside of Paris. And it's in five different centres that have set these up. And they set them up in the hope that these people would go there. Now, they haven't gone there because they don't feel safe there. Some have gone, but in general, most of the migrants who are there say, well, we don't want to be away from this community that's been set up there, and we're not really sure that what we'll get there is our papers to be checked. They're as concerned that this is actually just a quick to flick through, and they'll be put on a plane back home. The state, of course, is also providing a huge amount of money to prop up where they can these migrants. They've given 150 million euros in the last year to help wherever is possible.
That was Catherine Field in Paris speaking with our colleague Kate Pound Dawson. That brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Gao by Magic System. We've been listening to Magic System with the song Gao. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Let's know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.